Explaining Kierkegaard was presented by Dr. Jack Crabtree at a Saturday conference entitled Kierkegaard's Coffee House on April 14, 2007. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm thinking that more profit will come from question and answers than from me talking, so I'm gonna blitz through here and hope that this can just be provocative and provoke some questions. My initial disclaimer is that I don't pretend to have any expertise in Kierkegaard. There are many of our students at Gutenberg who have read more and have mastered Kierkegaard more than I have, and they would be better resources for you than I would be on Kierkegaard. If I have any expertise at all, my expertise is in the New Testament. So the perspective I bring to this is not to be a resource so that you can have an authority on Kierkegaard speaking to you, but someone who I think has some perspective to be able to ask the question and answer the question, is Kierkegaard a Christian? I mean, is he talking about what the New Testament is talking about? And I think that's what I can bring to it. Let me give you a little bit of background and why I didn't read Kierkegaard for about 15 years of my life. I was raised in a cultural Christian environment, a church, kind of a standard mainline, you might even call it fundamentalistic, although I wouldn't even dignify it with that sometimes, but a typical American conservative Bible-believing church with all the culture and all the cultural trappings that go with that. And part of that was, I didn't know it at the time, but part of that was is a very strong anti-intellectual current in that culture. I went away to Stanford University to go to college, which was a pretty heady environment, a pretty intellectual environment. And I went away swearing that I was going to keep the faith no matter what, because there was only one thing I was convinced of, is that Jesus had something true about him that I needed to hang on to. But I was just going to hang on to that. Now, as it turns out, I don't think if it hadn't been for the grace of God to bring into my life some very thoughtful and literate and educated Christians who helped me work through a lot of the issues. If it hadn't been for that, I don't think I could have kept my own vow because there's something about being made in the image of God and having a mind that God expects me to use that also resonated with me. I believed that I needed to have a thoughtful faith, and I wasn't in of myself already equipped to be able to meet the challenges of a secular university. But one of the people I was introduced to for the first time in college was Kierkegaard. And this was back in the 60s, and Kierkegaard was actually being very widely read by a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds back in the 60s. I did my part to read some Kierkegaard and try to appreciate him or critique him or whatever. And a combination of three things, I think, made me pass a negative judgment on Kierkegaard and basically just reject him, put him on the shelf such that I didn't even look at him again for 15 years. One was just my own impulse as a knee-jerk fundamentalist Christian. Fundamentalism doesn't have the categories of true and false. They have the categories of safe and unsafe. There are people that are safe to read, and there are other people that are unsafe to read, and you stay away from them. You don't want to be contaminated by them. You don't want them to influence you. And that was very much, I think, the mindset that I had absorbed from my culture. Kierkegaard just doesn't sound Christian, especially if you don't read the right works of Kierkegaard, especially if you're reading his more philosophical works. He doesn't sound like a fundamentalist. And since he didn't sound like a fundamentalist, he didn't sound safe. And since he didn't sound safe, I wasn't going to be reading him. So part of that was just personal. The other part of that is that Francis Schaeffer was coming on the scene about that time. And Schaeffer's treatment of Kierkegaard is kind of mixed. You know, Schaeffer gives you a sentence or two saying, I'm not saying he wasn't a Christian. He may very well have been a Christian. But he was instrumental in driving this wedge between the upper story and the lower story, if you're familiar with his thought at all. That Kierkegaard was one of the people who made that division between upper and story in the history of Western thought all the more the gap all the wider. Now, frankly, I think Schaeffer's not altogether wrong about that. Because Kierkegaard, it's one thing to talk about Kierkegaard as a person and what he was saying and what he was contributing and what his project was and what he was trying to accomplish. That's one thing. His impact on intellectual history is an entirely different question. And unfortunately, what happened is Kierkegaard got appropriated by people who were not Christians. And the most notable, of course, is Sartre, I think. And that comes to the third reason I put Kierkegaard on the shelf. Everything that I learned in academia about Kierkegaard was Kierkegaard read through the secular lenses of the 1960s, and everybody thought Kierkegaard was Jean-Paul Sartre. And so you tended to read Kierkegaard and interpret his language, his arguments, and so on, as if he were promoting the same kind of perspectives and the same kind of worldview of French existentialism. So I just decided, as someone who was interested in Christianity and as someone who was trying to come to terms with the Bible and what it taught and the truth in the Bible, I had other and better things to do than to read Kierkegaard, because he wasn't going to contribute to my project all that much. 15 years later, for reasons I won't get into, I go back to graduate school. And I'm in the philosophy department. I'm getting a PhD in philosophy. And in order to afford it, I'm a graduate teaching fellow in a class on existentialism. I just got assigned that. And you don't do a class on existentialism without doing a little bit of Kierkegaard, so we were assigned some reading in Kierkegaard. Well, let me back up. Remember, this is 15 years later. In the meantime, I have been devoting myself primarily to the New Testament. And that, like I say, that's what I would consider my expertise. I was really trying to come to terms with what is this gospel that the apostles and Jesus are talking about, that the New Testament is talking about here. What is this gospel? And I've made paradigm shift after paradigm shift after paradigm shift in the course of those 15 years in coming to terms with the New Testament and what it's talking about. So the me who had read Kierkegaard as an undergraduate was a very, very different me 15 years later. The only thing that remained the same was the name. I was a Christian. But there wasn't anything about my Christianity 15 years later that resembled the Christianity of 15 years before when I was first trying to read Kierkegaard. So I get ready for my discussion group by reading the assigned reading in Kierkegaard, and I just my jaw drops. Kierkegaard, where have you been all my life? I mean, just everything that I had been discovering, everything that I had been learning, I realized this dude knew it centuries before I did. I mean, this is just wonderful stuff. And so I found a new friend in Kierkegaard, and so from then on I have learned to appreciate that. Mostly what I learned is that Kierkegaard is getting his material from the New Testament, basically. He's a very penetrating thinker, a very incisive thinker, a profound thinker, a keen thinker, but his material is not his own. He's a student of the New Testament, and he's absorbing what this New Testament Christianity is all about and attempting to reframe that and rephrase it and articulate that in a fresh way to his particular generation. So I started reading Kierkegaard again, but that's why I hadn't read him for 15 years. So let's begin by talking about what I think the mistakes were that led to me so getting him so wrong the first time I read him. And I have two different cracks at that. One way, the fundamental mistake I made in my first reading of Kierkegaard, it could be put this way. As a philosopher, as a philosophy student, as a philosophy student who is keenly interested in epistemology, who is keenly interested in understanding whether or not, how we know whether our beliefs are warranted and so on, I just assumed that that's what Kierkegaard was talking about. So and that was wrong. The last thing Kierkegaard is actually interested in is the epistemology of religious belief. That's the last thing he's interested in. Rather, Kierkegaard's project is to explore the spiritual realities and the dynamics of the Christian faith. He's engaged in articulating a theory of Christian spirituality, of Christian faith, not a theory of knowledge. Now, the two overlap a little bit, that's true, and Kierkegaard is keenly aware of the overlap. But it's not the rationality of belief that interests him, it's the existentiality of belief that interests him, and I'll define that in a second. But it's not an issue of whether or not the belief is rational. It's an issue of whether or not we're going to do it. Are we going to make the commitment? Are we going to actually embrace it? Are we actually going to believe? And what is it that makes the difference between why one person does believe and another person does not? The rationality of belief he takes for granted, I would argue. And that was so incredibly confusing to me, because you read all kinds of sentences in Kierkegaard that throw you. Truth is subjectivity. Well, you can imagine the fundamentalist me wannabe intellectual me, confronting a phrase like truth is subjectivity and accepting that. No, truth is objective. It's the objective truth. It's the historical truth. We really believe that Jesus really existed and these things really happened, and that's the foundation and ground of our faith. And if that's not the foundation and ground of our faith, then we're some kind of liberal neo-Orthodox Christian, but we're not real Christians. I mean, that's how I responded. But it's because I wasn't understanding his project that I didn't understand that when he says truth is subjectivity, he's not denying the objective reality of God and Jesus and everything that Jesus taught. He's not denying that at all. He's taking that for granted. But what he's trying to say is, so what if Christianity is objectively true and you don't believe it? Doesn't do you any good if you don't believe it. So how do you get from not believing it to believing it? That's the interesting question. That's the crucial question. Another way of articulating the mistake I made, I think, could be looked at this way. Kierkegaard is not asking, is Christianity objectively true, as I've just said. He's taking it for granted that it's objectively true. Or Kierkegaard is not asking, is one rationally justified in believing in Christianity? He would assume that, of course, you are. He's not asking, is there objective evidence for the truth of Christianity? He would assume that there is, sure. He's not asking, does it matter whether there is objective evidence for the truth of Christianity? I would argue that his answer would be, well, yes, it matters. He would assume so. How can you embrace something as true if you have no reason to think it's true? Of course, that's just commonsensical. That's just rational. That makes sense. And I think Kierkegaard is not defying common sense in his writings. He's presuming that we would be commonsensical enough to not dare think that you would embrace something that's irrational. Of course you wouldn't do that. Well, that wasn't my first reading. I believed he was a fideist, that your belief in Christianity was its own justification, and that the faith was actually objectively irrational, and that was the virtue of it. Well, I didn't much like that, nor should I have liked that, nor I think would Kierkegaard much like that. That's not his perspective. Rather, what Kierkegaard is asking is, who is the person who has authentic faith? Who is it who has authentic faith? Who is the person who embraces the truth of Christianity in such a way that he will be saved? What does true, authentic, saving faith look like? Remember the background that David laid out for you. He's in a society where there are, as to use his numbers, I don't know if they're hyperbole or not, there are millions of Christians in Denmark. His question is, of these millions of Christians in Denmark, who's going to receive eternal life? Who's going to be saved? In other words, whose faith is genuine and authentic faith? That's his project, is to answer that set of questions. Okay, keeping that in mind, let me just define some terms. Kierkegaard is considered in the history of philosophy the father of existentialism, but let me define existentialism. I got this from my professor at University of Oregon, and this was very helpful to me. It's a very simple distinction you need to make. Most isms in philosophy are defining a worldview, a set of beliefs, a school of thought that share a common take on reality in one way or the other. And so rationalism, empiricism, subjectivism, they have a particular distinctive doctrine or set of doctrines that define them. That's not the case with existentialism. Existentialists who hold widely different beliefs about reality, and yet they are all existentialists. So you have a Dostoevsky and Kierkegaard on the one hand, who are Christian believers that you would want to identify as existentialism, and they embrace a Christian worldview based on Christian Judeo-Christian theism. On the other hand, you have a Sartre or Camus who embrace a worldview based on atheism, and in Sartre's case, his own kind of brand of nihilism. Nietzsche probably shouldn't even be classed as an existentialist, although a lot of people do. He's a materialist who embraces a worldview based on his own idiosyncratic synthesis of Darwinism and Stoicism. Well, there's nothing Christian about a Nietzsche. There's nothing Christian about Sartre, and yet they are still existentialist. Well, what makes an existentialist an existentialist? Why would you categorize them together? Not because they have shared belief systems, but because they have a shared perspective on two or three things here. One, they have a shared perspective on the nature of the philosophical task. From their perspective, the nature of the philosophical task is to understand human existence. In contrast to Plato, for example, or even more importantly, Plotinus, the one who started Neoplatonism, where the task of philosophy is to engage in these grand philosophical speculations. I mean, in one way, both the weakness of Greek philosophy and the genius of Greek philosophy is that the Greek culture, the Greek intellectual culture, decided there is no question that I can't answer. And they're quite able and willing to let their minds go and out of their own imaginations come up with some rationalization of their answer to unanswerable questions. Didn't make any difference that no human being in his right mind would ever think he knew the answer to that question. The Greeks came up with it anyway. Well, there's another strand of philosophy that looks at that and says, I don't think you know what you're talking about. I mean, you're just speculating. You're just making this stuff up. You're just blowing smoke. But there are some things that we can explore and examine and dialogue about and have a conversation about and maybe come to some answers about. And that's the nature of our own existence. Who am I? Why am I here? What am I supposed to do with my life? And so on. Existentialists are those people who narrow the focus of their philosophical investigation to the set of questions that concern the nature of human existence itself. Which is to say, a part of their perspective is that those are the questions that are most worth addressing. Those are the important questions. So those are questions concerning the nature of human existence, but it's not just human existence in the abstract. It's concerning the nature of individual human existence, even more specifically, my individual human existence, addressing the questions that concern who I am. Who am I? How am I to exist? In what should I invest my existence? That kind of question. Any question that gets at the nature of my own individual particular existence in this world and how I ought to live. Then you would find, and this is the closest thing that existentialists get to a shared belief system, you would have a minimal set of foundational assumptions that all existentialists would share. One is that the human individual is self-defining. The human individual, by the choices that he makes in life, is defining his existence. Second one that is correlated with that, the human individual is free with respect to those self-defining choices, or at least ought to be free and ought to operate in their freedom. It, you know, bad faith for Sartre is having someone else tell you how to live. Society, culture, your parents, your professor, or someone else dictate to you what you should be committed to. That's what he calls bad faith. To be an authentic human individual, I need to take responsibility for what I'm going to commit to in my life and therefore how I'm going to define my own personal existence. And I think that's my next point. The human individual is responsible for the self-defining choices he makes. And then finally, the human individual cannot and must not try to shift responsibility for his self-defining choices onto someone else and remove it from himself. Okay, that's the shared perspective that defines this loosely knit group of philosophers and thinkers that we call existentialists. What was striking to me when the professor laid out this perspective on existentialism is it's interesting because I don't think there would be such a thing as existentialism if it weren't for Christianity, or at least the Judeo-Christian tradition. Who were the first existentialists? The Hebrew prophets were the first existentialists, calling Israel to take responsibility for their relationship to their God, for their commitment to their God. Are you going to take that commitment seriously, or you're not going to take that commitment seriously? Are you going to live like your neighbors, or are you going to take responsibility for yourself and do right by your relationship to God in spite of the fact that other people are pressuring you not to? Then certainly when you get to Jesus and the apostles, they are thoroughgoing existentialists by this definition. There's no question about that. The only pagan existentialist of old would be Socrates. Socrates was clearly an existentialist and had a huge impact on his culture. And I think, frankly, my own private opinion is he was a prophet to the Greeks, but that's another day. Okay, with that in mind then, let's define some terms. So if we're going to understand existentialism, what do they mean by existence? By existence, existentialism comes from the word existence. Existential is of or pertaining to existence, and existentialism is that style of doing philosophy that has to do with that which is of or pertaining to existence. So the key term here is existence. What do they mean by that? They mean the existence of a particular individual human being, not existence in the abstract, not humanity in the abstract, but my own concrete individual particular existence. That's existence. Existential is of or pertaining to that. So what's the existential question? The existential question is, how will I, as a particular concrete individual, define my own particular individual existence? Who will I be? Who will I be? That's the existential question. For Kierkegaard, the question of faith just is a particular form of the existential question. In fact, it is the ultimate existential question for Kierkegaard. Who will I be, name and in particular, will I decide to be a human being who defines his life and choices by the truth of Christianity or not? And that is, he's famous for his dichotomy either or. He has a whole work called Either Or, and that dichotomy comes up throughout his writing. Either we will or we won't, and it's pretty much up to me. Nobody can make me become a Christian. Nobody can make me define myself by the truth of Christianity. That's a lonely individual decision that I'm stuck with. I and I alone must face into the question, will you define your life and existence by the truth of what Jesus came and taught? What is an existential crisis? An existential crisis is a critical event in our lives that raises the question, who do you want to be? By what do you want your existence to be defined? So not just any crisis in my life is an existential crisis. Some crises in my life are just hard times. It's just suffering. It's just tribulation. It's just trial and so on. But every now and then, a crisis comes into my life that actually raises the question in a live way such that I could go either or You know, I could go this way or I could go the other way in terms of what I want my life to be defined by. You know, do I want it to be defined by Christianity or not? Do I want to live my life in the light of the truth of Christianity, or do I want to shine it on? That's an existential crisis when I face that question. And the existential decision, of course, then is making a decision that is tantamount to deciding that you want your existence to be defined by something. An existential commitment is a commitment that defines the very meaning and definition of my own individual particular concrete existence. Not every commitment is an existential commitment. I can make a commitment to a job without it being an existential commitment. I can make a commitment to a group of people without it being an existential commitment. I'm just being responsible. I'm just making a promise. I'm just making a commitment. But if the commitment that I make is on such an order that it defines the very nature of my personal existence, then it's an existential commitment. Okay. With that in the background, then, let me look at what I think are three of the most important questions that Kierkegaard is addressing in his throughout his works. And remember, I'm not a Kierkegaard scholar. These are just the ones that have struck me and have impacted me profoundly. The first one, if a person is a Christian who believes that Christianity is true, do they then have what the Bible calls faith? And a lot of his writing, some of your reading today, dealt with this question. Is it enough to believe that Christianity is true to say that you have faith? And his answer is clearly no, not necessarily. And his whole perspective, he gets at this in a number of different ways, but if faith is as easy as that, if faith is as easy as just simply believing that Christianity is true and Jesus is the Christ and the various claims that Christians make, if it's just saying that you think those things are true, then how is it that what Jesus taught, how is that true? Jesus taught that the way to eternal life is exceedingly narrow and few pass that way. And Kierkegaard has some very, very humorous passages about all those millions of Christians in Denmark trying to crowd through the narrow way. It's a very funny image. But there's a very profound point behind that. Is that we obviously have misunderstood what faith is if we think that this way that is exceedingly narrow that few are passing down, we are passing the judgment that all million of us are in, that all of us have got it made. And he thinks there's something funky about that view of faith. He argues that true saving faith must be a faith that believes in Jesus from the standpoint of contemporaneity, and you looked at that in your reading for today. I'm not altogether sure I understand fully what he means by that. I'm inclined to think that there's two sides of that, and that he means two things by it at different places in his writings. On the one hand, he means that in order to be a true Christian, it's not, we don't embrace the Jesus of 2,000 years of history, the triumphant Jesus, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, the Lord of his glorious and wealthy church, the Lord of millions and millions of people who sing praises to his name. And his point is, there's so much glory in that Jesus, who wouldn't believe in that Jesus? Who wouldn't believe that Jesus is the Messiah? But the true believer is the one who transports himself back in, puts himself in the shoes of the original disciples. Who is the Jesus that they had to profess is the Christ? A poor, simple Galilean peasant who had nothing in particular to recommend himself outwardly, and who was crucified on the cross by the Romans, was mocked by them, was held in contempt by most of the nation, who was an utter failure in his life. With all of his proclaiming the kingdom of God, it appeared to come to an abrupt end as the powerful Romans stepped in and just crushed it and put an end to that. And they were being asked to confess that Jesus as Lord. and as King of Kings, as the Son of God, as the Messiah. And what Kierkegaard is saying is, until I go back and face the question that they faced and answer the question that the way they answered it, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, until I say that of the Jesus that they were speaking of, then I don't have true faith. I think in some contexts that's what he means by the standpoint of contemporaneity, being contemporaneous with the Christ that they were contemporaneous with, who delivered his timeless message about God and mankind to them at that time. But in the reading that we had today, he seems to be taking it in a somewhat different direction, and that tends to be more that we have to understand Jesus as being contemporaneous with me. I have to bring Jesus, who really is timeless, whose message is timeless, whose message is in another kind of history that doesn't evolve and develop and morph and change and transform itself over time, but it's just always the same, confronting every human being throughout all time, no matter what culture they're in, no matter what language they speak, no matter who they are. There is still a Jesus and his message that confronts them and raises the existential questions and creates the existential crisis. What are you going to do with me? And it's bringing that Christ forward into my time and my situation, confronting me now with, are you in your situation, Jack, going to believe this truth, believe this teaching, believe this message? And that and only that is true faith. And I think what he has in mind is in part Hegel. David mentioned the Hegel as the backdrop to this. Because whether he gets Hegel right or not is another question. But he's not dealing with Hegel directly, I don't think. He's dealing with the way Hegelian thought had an impact on the Christian church in Denmark in his day. And as best I would understand how Kierkegaard sees that, is that Hegel had given support for this kind of triumphalism in the church. I mean, Hegel, one of the things that Hegel says is, you've got this evolution of religion throughout time, and the apex of that developmental evolutionary process in religion was Christianity. Christianity is the highest form of religion, and Christianity in Germany is the highest form of Christianity. I mean, that may not be true, but that's certainly within the spirit of Hegel. And Luther's looking at that triumphalism in Hegel as that got embraced by the church in Denmark, and he's saying, well, if this is the apex of the evolution of rationality and religious thought, who wouldn't embrace it? Of course. That's a no-brainer. But that's not the Christianity that we're being called upon to embrace in order to be rightly related to God. The Christianity that we're being asked to embrace is the Christianity that the disciples of Jesus embraced, not the disciples of Hegel have embraced. And Hegel's Christianity was all about history. And the Christianity that evolved over time in history. And in that regard, Kierkegaard is stepping outside of history and saying, no, the faith that we are to embrace is very unhistorical. It's very contrary to the historical. Jesus has always spoken and raised the same question constantly, absolutely, without qualification, without change, without transformation to every human being who's always lived throughout all time. And it's the same question that he confronts them with. It doesn't change. Okay, the second important question that Kierkegaard addresses is, can a person come to saving faith by being convinced of the truth of Christianity through objective evidence? And Kierkegaard's answer is no, not at all. Now, just on an aside, this was really a stumbling block to me the first time I read Kierkegaard. I mean, because the other books I was reading is Evidence That Demands a Verdict and all kinds of apologetic books and all kinds of arguments and reasons for why Christianity is true. And here Kierkegaard is coming along and saying, no, it's not the evidence. You know? And I thought what he was saying is, not only is it not the evidence, but there is no evidence, Christianity is irrational. Christianity is absurd. Christianity doesn't really make any sense. There's no reason anyone in their right mind would believe Christianity. Ah, but the virtue is that you believe it anyway. Well, if you can put yourself in my shoes and hear that from where I was coming from, why would I listen to that? But what he's saying is profoundly true. What he's saying is not that there is no objective evidence, but what he's saying is there's no objective evidence that has ever led someone to become a Christian. Let me illustrate it with his famous leap of faith. In his concluding unscientific postscript, he has a passage where he talks about the German philosopher Lessing. Lessing was an agnostic, atheist philosopher in Germany, who at one point in conversation or dialogue with another philosopher had argued that, I would love to be a Christian. You know, I would love to have faith. I don't have any problem with having faith. It's a wonderful thing that all you nice Christians are nice Christians. And I would love to make a choice to be a Christian myself. But you see, I got this problem. Because as I look at the evidence for Christianity and evidence for the truth of Christianity, I come up to this point where Christianity is on the other side of a chasm. I'm sitting here on this side of the ditch, the chasm. Christianity is on the other side of the chasm. And there's no objective evidence to pave the way, to pave the path over the chasm for me. So the only way I could become a Christian is by taking this blind leap to the other side of the chasm. And he says, implies, that's nice that you have done that, who have done that, but I'm too rational, you know, I'm too intellectually responsible, I have too much intellectual integrity to do that myself, so here I am stuck on this side of the ditch. Well, that's Lessing's ditch. Kierkegaard responds to Lessing in a typically kind of ironic, sarcastic, smart-alecky kind of way by saying, you know, Lessing is right. He's interacting with the philosopher who tried to argue with him and tried to argue, but there was objective evidence for Christianity. And Kierkegaard basically, as a way of saying, you're approaching this the wrong way, he says, no, Lessing's right. This other dude, I don't remember his name, this other dude's wrong. Lessing is right. There is this ditch, and it takes a leap to get to faith. But what Kierkegaard was getting at is there is a ditch, but Lessing has misunderstood the nature of the gap. Lessing has thought that the only thing that would be required in order to make him a Christian is to get dump trucks full of evidence to fill in the chasm and bring it up to level so he can walk across on a level ground. He thinks lack of evidence is all that is the problem. But Kierkegaard says the problem is not a lack of evidence. The problem is a lack of desire. Kierkegaard speaks often of passion. And what he's getting at, this is really at the heart of Kierkegaard's thought, is that, and this is so true to the New Testament, as I understand the New Testament better, there's really two important aspects to faith. There's the intellectual and the rational aspect of faith, which is very real. Faith wouldn't be faith without the intellectual and rational aspect of faith. But there's also a volitional or passional aspect of faith. Belief, most beliefs, we don't notice this with respect to most beliefs, but nobody can make you believe something you don't want to believe. Now, mostly we don't see that because mostly we don't see a gap between what I want to believe and what my reason tells me is true. You know, do I believe 2 + 2 = 4? Yeah. Do I want to believe it? Yeah, sure. At least it's not causing many problems to believe that. The only time you really begin to see the split between what my head tells me is true and what I want to believe is when a sinner, who by his very nature sort of has animosity toward God and the things of God, is brought too close to God. And your mind tells you God is there, and you owe him gratitude, and you owe him obedience and your service and so on. But the sinful antagonism within you says, but I don't want to go there. I don't want to bow my knee to no stinking God. And so there's the split between what your reason informs you is true on the one hand and what you are willing to acknowledge as true on the other hand. And when those come into conflict, then one begins to see that it takes more than evidence. It takes more than arguments. It takes more than good reasons to convince someone, if you will, to actually make the commitment to the truth of Christianity. Because all the arguments and evidence and reasons in the world are not going to solve the most fundamental of all problems. And that is, are you willing for it to be true? Because if you're not willing for it to be true, all the arguments are going to be worthless and pointless. Here's a quote from Kierkegaard's point in that passage where he talks about the leap of faith. He just sort of offhandedly says at some point that every ditch is infinitely broad to the one who does not want to leap. The way he puts it, the exact quote is, as if it were not the dialectically passionate loathing of the leap that makes the ditch infinitely broad. The reason I can't jump over it is because I don't want to jump at all, is his point. And so he was basically saying to his culture, to his time and place, and this is a timeless truth, that our problem is not the rationality of our faith. That's not our problem. The problem is something more fundamental and deeper. It's that our passions are wrong. It's that our passions are aligned in such a way that, how's he call it? We have a dialectically passionate loathing of the leap. And I think what he means by that is a dialectically passionate loathing of Christianity, the truth of Christianity, of God, and the things of God that I would be leaping to. Okay, the third important question that I think he addresses is the question, what does true saving faith require? What is the nature and character of true saving faith? And this is where Kierkegaard is, I think, most helpful to us today, because he was such a keen observer of human nature and of his time in relationship to the truth of New Testament Christianity. And there are several points here that I'm going to make in response to this, and this certainly is not exhaustive. But the first one, true saving faith is a way of life, and he calls it the religious way of life. In my idiom, I wouldn't call it the religious way of life, because religion, for me, I would identify more with the Phariseeism of the New Testament, I stumbled over this for a while, but I realized that for Kierkegaard, religion is a positive thing, not a negative thing. The Phariseeism, if anything, he would call the ethical way of life, but faith is the religious way of life. There are three different modes of life from his perspective. There's the aesthetic way of life, which has nothing to do with art and beauty. Comes from the Greek word for the senses. Aesthetes are the senses. So the aesthetic way of life is the life of the hedonist, the life of the person who's looking for the stimulation of their senses so that their sense experience is the actual meaning of their life. He has, in his work, Either Or, he has just wonderful critique of the aesthetic way of life. In fact, Either Or is not even about the religious way of life or the way of faith for the most part. Either Or is just about making a decision, an existential decision. Are you going to live an aesthetic way of life or an ethical way of life? And he makes the case in that book for the ethical way of life over the aesthetic way of life. And he points out, I think quite accurately, that the problem with the aesthetic way of life is staving off boredom. I mean, that's what your life consists of, is just not being bored. He has one passage in Either Or that, you start reading it, and you go to the front cover to make sure you're reading Kierkegaard. It's a book on farming. It's all about crop rotation and how you need to keep rotating your crops in the fields so that they don't become, what do they become? Fallow, yeah. But his point is, that's the aesthetic way of life. The aesthetic way of life is just like the farmer having to rotate his crops in his fields. You have to go from one thing to the next thing to the next thing to the next thing in your life. It always has to be new. It always has to be fresh. It always has to be novel just to keep it alive and to keep yourself from being bored. The second way of life is the ethical way of life. And the ethical way of life is, for him, just basically pursuing moral goodness, pursuing righteousness, moral integrity in your life. He's not against it. He's for it, as we will see. His critique of the ethical way of life, his complaint against the ethical way of life, is that if you make it all that your life is all about, then you are not a believer. Then you are not a Christian believer. That is to be found in what he calls the religious way of life. He makes a point several times of saying the religious way of life incorporates the ethical way of life. It doesn't negate it. It doesn't nullify it. The religious person will be an ethical person. You can't have a religious person who is not an ethical person. So it incorporates the ethical way of life, but it is not exhausted by the ethical way of life. It transcends it. And there are dimensions to the religious way of life that are not there in the ethical way of life. I'll say more about that in a second. I think it's in my notes. If not, I'll come back to it. Second way of answering the question, what's the nature and character of true saving faith? True saving faith is what he calls, in various places, an infinite commitment to the infinite. Now, by the infinite, usually the infinite is just a euphemism for God, but I think he uses the word infinite because it's more than God. It's God and the things of God, the things that pertain to God, is the infinite. To make an infinite commitment to the infinite is to make a commitment to the infinite that is not in any way bounded or qualified. It would be finite if there were some boundaries that you could come up to where your commitment would cease. But if you can't find any boundaries across which would bring an end to your commitment, then that is an infinite commitment. I think what he has in mind is the parable of that Jesus tells about the pearl merchant who traffics in pearls, and he finds a pearl of such surpassing value that he sells everything that he has and purchases it, in that parable. I mean, the thing that's striking about that parable is he sells everything he owns. I mean, like, everything. That's a pretty valuable pearl. There were no boundaries. There were no limits on what he wasn't willing to sacrifice or give up or go without or forsake in order to have that one pearl. That's an infinite commitment. And that's the commitment that the true believer, the true Christian makes, is an infinite commitment. There is nothing that we are not willing to give up or forsake or do without in order to lay hold of being rightly related to the infinite God and the truth of God and so on. In one of his works called Purity of Heart, he explores that at length and shows all the subtle ways that we deceive ourselves into thinking that we have purity of heart when in fact we don't. It's a wonderful work. And in the Purity of Heart, he defines purity of heart as to will one thing. That's where, again, less informed me when I first read him, I thought he meant to will one thing no matter what it is. But that's not what Kierkegaard is saying. He's not saying no matter what it is. I mean, if it's the wrong thing, you're a fool. But if the one thing is the infinite, if the one thing is the truth of Christianity, then you are objectively relating to that which is objectively true and objectively important. But the question is, are you going to will it? That's the existential question. But are you going to be rightly related to it? Yeah, it's there to be related to, and it's true, and it's objective reality, and it's absolute. But what are you going to do about it? Are you going to be rightly related to it? And so purity of heart, and he's taking that phrase out of the Beatitudes from Jesus. What does Jesus mean by purity of heart? Well, he concludes, purity of heart is to will one thing. And I think what he means by that is to will one and only one thing, which is to say, I want the kingdom of God, and I'm willing to give up anything else in order to get it. The kingdom of God is the only thing I want. You can take everything else away from me, God, but grant me the kingdom of God. Third thing he says in answer to the nature of that faith, true saving faith is a commitment that defines one's very existence. It's an existential commitment to God and the things of God. True saving faith is a commitment that defines one's very self, and I think that's been implicit already in what I've been saying. Makes a fourth point. True saving faith is a commitment I make for myself and for God, not for other people. Not for parents, not for social standing, not so that I might be respected in the community, whatever else it might be. It's not for anything else other than a commitment I'm making to define myself and for myself. It's always for God, of course, because all things are for God. That's taken for granted. But short of God, I don't do it for anyone other than myself. If it is made for other people, it's not true saving faith. And so you can see how important a clarification this is in his context. I mean, when the reason you're a Christian is because it's for the queen or the king, it's for my parents, it's for Denmark, it's for, you know, it's for everything around me. But he's saying, well, that's not saving faith. If you're not defining yourself by this commitment, then it's not really what the Bible calls faith. Fifth point he makes. True saving faith is what he calls an unmediated commitment to God. If it is mediated by something else, it is not true saving faith. I don't know why I have C below there. Maybe we'll find out below. It's not mediated by outward religious expression. It's not mediated by religious piety. Now, what does he mean by mediated there? Basically, what he's arguing is that faith is an infinite commitment to the infinite, right? It's a commitment of me in my individual, particular, concrete personhood to the God who is there, to God who is there. But I'm doing business with God as God. If I do business with something else that is not God and call it doing business with God, that's mediated. That's what he calls being mediated. I'm getting to being rightly related to God by being rightly related in my own mind to something else instead. And Kierkegaard rejects all mediation. You're doing business with God and God directly, or otherwise you don't believe. You don't have true faith. Well, this is one of the most helpful concepts that I get from Kierkegaard, because it just seems so really true. It is certainly true of my own experience. I mean, growing up in Christian culture, how was I rightly related to God? I didn't smoke, I didn't drink, I didn't dance, I didn't go to movies. And by being rightly related to movies and dancing and tobacco and alcohol, I was being rightly related to God. I was mediating my relationship to God. Oftentimes, in most of our cultures, we develop a cultural persona that we, by adopting that cultural persona, we are being rightly related to God. It's a form of piety that we develop, and each tradition has its own form of piety. But the way I use my language, the way I dress, perhaps, what I talk about, the topics of conversation, and so on. I'm constantly sending out signals to you. I love God. I love God. See how often I say praise Jesus. See how often I do this. See how I dress. Whatever. There's all these outward manifestations that are simply my symbolic representations to you for your benefit, that you might know how godly I am, that you might know how rightly related to God I am. But Kierkegaard's problem is, but that's a mediated relationship to God. You think you're relating to God when you're just relating to your clothes or to your speech or to your whatever your concept of piety is. This is more challenging, but I think he's right. It's also not mediated by morality. Now, this is tricky. You have to be clear what he means by this, because it's not what you think. In Faith, in Fear and Trembling, he introduces the notion of the teleological suspension of the ethical. And it's in the context of his account of Abraham offering up Isaac. And let me give you an oversimplified version of this. It's been a while since I've read Fear and Trembling, so don't trust me on any of the particulars here. But Abraham is being asked by God to do something immoral. Any ethical system, any moral system, any set of moral laws would say, fathers, don't be off on your kids. You know, don't be killing your kids. That's wrong. And that law, that rule, that standard is out there as the standard of morality. Well, God comes along and says to Abraham, I'm the God who made you the promise. I'm the God that you walk before. I'm the God that you serve. Kill your son. Offer him up to me as an offering. And Kierkegaard just struggles with what a dilemma that put Abraham in, and what's going on there, and what's that all about. Well, Kierkegaard concludes that Abraham did the right thing, and what that says to him, what that means to him, is there's something more important than morality. And what's more important than morality is that I be rightly related to God, rightly related to the infinite. Because otherwise, if I think I'm serving God by serving my moral rules, my moral system, my moral standards, then my morality, my moral system, is mediating my relationship to God. And true faith is an unmediated relationship to God. Now, what helps me understand this, he doesn't say this, but you know, this is a very provocative kind of idea that's had me thinking over the years. I think the way I have to make sense out of that is it's crucial to understand something that I think Kierkegaard takes for granted, and that is morality is ultimately not from God. Morality is ultimately human in the sense that, let me back up. I was reading an introduction to ethics by a philosopher named Louis Poyman, who made a very, very helpful distinction. He said there's a distinction between saying that morality is absolute and that morality is objectively true. Those are two different claims. And oftentimes we as Christians are champions of moral absolutes. But really, we're not really champions of moral absolutes. What we really mean to be championing is the objective truth of morality. So the difference is this. When you say that there are moral absolutes, what you're saying is there's some rule out there that I can identify, some articulation of morality that I can identify that is absolute. And by saying absolute, we mean absolutely applicable and inviolable. No matter what context, no matter what situation you find yourself in, this rule will apply. Well, there may in fact be some moral absolutes. I don't know. I can't make up my mind about that. But whether there are or not, that's not the important issue. The important issue is whether moral truth is objectively true. So we live in a world, we live in a culture and an environment that says your moral judgment in any given situation is kind of your own preference. You know, it's your own thing, it's your own business. And I can have my moral judgment and you can have your moral judgment about the same exact situation, and we're both making equally valid judgments. I'm just making it from my perspective and you're making it from your perspective. As biblical Christians, we believe that those moral judgments are objective, so they're either true or false. One of us is right and one of us is wrong if our judgments differ, because morality is just as objectively real as the other laws of reality, physical laws, for example. But just because a judgment in a particular situation is either objectively true or objectively false doesn't mean that a law like thou shalt not kill is absolute. Because the law may apply in most situations, but what do you do when you get in a situation where God himself, who you clearly know is God himself, has come to you and said, take the life of your son and offer him up to me. Now does the rule thou shalt not kill apply? Well, no. it would be objectively wrong, it would be objectively immoral for me to disobey God in order to keep my rule. In any case, that's what Kierkegaard is saying, and that's what he's calling the teleological suspension of the ethical. Okay, lest I run out of time here. I'm already out of time, aren't I?
Well, 5 more minutes and then we'll
okay.
Questions.
Okay, let me just read through these last three quickly. True saving faith is inextricably bound together with a consciousness of my own personal sinfulness. Where there is not consciousness of my own sin and shame, there is not saving faith. Your reading had a lot to do with that, the end of your reading. True saving faith is a matter of what he calls inwardness. It is a matter of what is occurring in the inner depths of one's being, not what is occurring on the outside of one's being. I think that true saving faith is a matter of being a believer, not a matter of doing what a believer does. And the example he likes to use is he makes the point that it's one thing to be a dancer, it's another thing to do what he calls making the motions of the dance. If I dared do it in public, I would be a wonderful illustration of the difference between being a dancer and making the motions of a dance. That what he's getting at is when someone is a skilled dancer, it's almost like the motions of their dance are arising from inside and simply manifesting themselves in their outward actions and motions and behaviors. Someone like me, I just have to slap the motions of the dance on the outside. Oh, it looks like. And it becomes evident in just watching me. I mean, I'm going to be clumsy. I'm going to make the same motions more or less, but I'm not a dancer. And so he makes a distinction between being a believer and simply making the motions of belief. The one who's a believer is a believer from the inside out, at the depth of their being, at the core of their being, in what the Bible, I think, calls our heart. That in the heart of a person, we have made a commitment to know God and love God and be infinitely committed to the infinite. And that's a commitment that is made at the level of the deepest core of my being. What I do then simply expresses that commitment that is true on the inside. And that's the inwardness that Kierkegaard talks about. What Christianity is all too often willing to settle for is outwardness, to enculturate people into adopting certain outward forms and outward practices and outward expressions that the leaders in the church say, I'll call that good. You're one of us. You're a believer. You're a Christian. You dress like a Christian. You talk like a Christian. You praise like a Christian. You drink like a Christian. You smoke like a Christian. You eat like a Christian. You do everything that Christians do. I guess that makes you a Christian. And Kierkegaard would say, no, that doesn't make you a Christian. Just means you do things like Christians. But it doesn't make you one. Because what makes you one is something that has to be forged in an existential crisis where you actually make a choice. You make the leap. You make the decision, I want it. I want my life to be rightly related to the infinite. I want to make an infinite commitment to the infinite. And nobody can do that for you, and no one can give you steps for how to do that or give you outward forms to do that is going to make that a reality. It is a mysterious, secret, inner, hidden reality that has to happen within us as God works within us. It's exactly what Jesus was telling Nicodemus. Those who are born of the Spirit, he says the Spirit is like the wind. It blows where it wills, and you don't know where it came from, and you don't know where it's going. You know the leaves are rustling, but you don't know where the wind came from that rustled them. And that's what's true in our life. Just in the existential angst of our life, we resolve something or we don't. We either do or we don't. But if in the existential angst of our life something gets resolved deep down inside, I want to be infinitely committed to the infinite, then we have been born of the Spirit, Jesus would say. we are, in Kierkegaard's terms, a true Christian, or what he calls the knight of faith. Okay, and the last one is true saving faith involves embracing what is absurd. All he means by that, he doesn't mean what I took him to mean the first time, that Christianity is objectively ridiculous, objectively irrational, objectively absurd. What he means by that is there's no way in the world that any of us can ever encounter true Christianity without facing what feels like the absurdity of it, because it goes against everything that comes naturally to us. What comes naturally to us is to look out for number one, to look out for myself, to save my life. And Jesus comes along and says, you want to save your life? Then you need to lose it. He who loses his life will save it. He who loses it will find it. And that's the paradoxical absurdity of Christianity that we face on every turn. And if we took Christianity just at face value without making the commitment that the existential commitment of faith is, on the outside, it just looks like an obnoxious thing to believe. And faith is able to get past that, is able to get beyond the paradoxical absurdity of Christianity and believe it nonetheless. Okay, better quit there.